Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
We strongly encourage you to come back for more days. We're trying to do some scaffolding for you all. So if you can make it, we even have folders for you to build on the work.
It's official. Yeah, and so with this important work that we're doing here, we don't want to just stay in our heads. I've heard a lot of talk of embodiment, even in a lot of the other classes as well. So there's definitely something Holy Spirit is stirring with that. But saying that, I'm going to invite you all to rise as you're able, and we're going to get into our bodies at the very beginning. Every day we're going to make sure we get into our bodies. What we want to do here is called the Sawabona Circle. And so I'm going to play some music, and I'm going to invite you all to walk the space as your body feels led. And I want you to greet people, whoever comes into your space, and greet them with your eyes and with a smile in your eyes, or just make that eye contact, that connection. And I want you to say, I see you, I hear you, you matter. And keep moving around the space. And whoever you connect with, I want you to say that, I see you, I hear you, you matter. I want you both to say that to each other. We're going to keep moving around just for about a minute or so while the music's playing. I want to invite you all to do that to the space, to get into our bodies and to have that human-to-human connection. So, yeah, play some music here. You can do it without the music. You guys are doing amazing.
You know, it means I see you, but it means so much more than that. And how many times in this work do we not see each other? And so for Joe and I, part of this work is just being able to see others, be able to see ourselves, and to be able to see God in others. So that's what you just did. And I encourage you to, just the next time you greet somebody, to think to yourself, Sawubona, let me really see the fullness of this person's humanity, and let me see Christ, within, or God, the divine, within this person. So.
Yeah, and I want to share a piece of the, I think it's my
of course it is.
Right? Yeah, I think the battery light.
Okay.
Yeah. But so as Sharon mentioned, Dave and I are both full-time artists, and I do spoken word poetry, and so I write a lot about this type of work, and we get the opportunity to go to different churches and community spaces all across the country. Oftentimes, there are signs that say, all are welcome, or we love everyone. And I'm like, everyone? everyone? And so I wanted to write a piece that invited the question of what do we really mean when we say everyone? So I'm going to share a short spoken word piece about that called Who Is Your Everyone? We're going to get into delve into some of this work here. Who is your everyone? Is only those in the country you were born in, or migrant workers whose customs and cultures may seem foreign? Is only those in our church Sunday morning, or the non-religious, or Jews, or Muslims, or Mormons? With who does our everyone begin and end? Is only those with our zip code, our language, our skin? Can our vision extend beyond us versus them towards a bridge of love where true justice bends? Where all our walls crumble and fall between those people who make us feel so uncomfortable, different and distant, they seem so unlovable, but come closer, you'll discover that God loves them too. No more, no less, but just as much as you. This is the truth we often may forget. There is a table that offers all a place to sit, that of a transformational relationship when we celebrate everyone's human sacredness. We are them, and they are us, all created in God's image. Who is your everyone? Yeah, and so you know, as we're invited into that question and to think about that, we want to play a little game about how we make up stories about each other, about ourselves, because that's what humans do. We make up stories, right? Within seconds of seeing each other, we already have a story that we have about you know, the person that we're looking at, the people we're sharing space with. And so we want to play this game right here to guess which one of these stories is Dave's or my story. So, but if you turn it, if you get your folder, you actually have some space in there to write and to reflect on this. So yeah, you wanna?
Yeah, let's.
Not everyone has folders.
Okay, we only have 25, which means we may have to have Sharon make us some more copies here. How many do we have in here? More than 25, it looks like. Okay. And upstairs, okay.
Yeah.
We didn't know. We thought.
Yeah. In the meantime, in between time, what we can still do, I noticed that we have some paper here, so we can use this paper.
What we're gonna do is for this one is just an informal here little vote. So
we can even do it by maybe hand.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. We'll still make it work. Yeah.
So you get four votes. You either say Dave, Joe, both, or neither. So how many people think that Dave, me, grew up in Minot, North Dakota? Raise your hand if you think that's me.
So keep in mind, you got four votes. So you're either going to vote Dave, okay. Joe, both, or neither.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind when you raise your hand. So yeah. We're going to say each one. Yep.
How many people think it was Joe?
I have no idea.
How many people think it was both of us grew up in Minot? Hey, all right. How many people think it was neither? All right, would the real Minotian please raise his hand?
What? Yo, that's out there? Yeah.
Ooh, that's a cold place.
All right, so was a member of the Black Culture Club in high school? If you think it was me, raise your hand. They're like, oh, you mean North Dakota? Yeah, all right, got a couple of votes. If you think it was Dave, raise your hand. If you think it was both, raise your hand. And if you think it was neither, raise your hand. All right. And
the real Black Culture Club member, raise your hand.
Oh. Yeah.
All right, the next one is loves to watch The Office and Friends with his wife. How many people think it is Dave? Raise your hand.
I thought he was
Dun, 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 dun. Okay, how many think it was Joe? Both of you. How many people think it was both? How many people think it's neither? Okay. With the real friends and office watcher, raise his hand, please. We don't watch it. Yeah.
All right. All right, so is a vegetarian, if you think that that's me, raise your hand. Okay. If you think that that's only Dave, raise your hand. If you think that it's both, raise your hand. And if you think that it's neither, I am the only vegetarian. Yeah.
Okay, how many of us did not grow up in the Lutheran church? Was that Dave? Raise your hand. Joe, raise your hand. Both, raise your hand. Neither, raise your hand. All right. Would the real not growing up in the Lutheran church person raise your hand? And I need a caveat to say, in the summertime, I did visit my dad, and we would go to a Lutheran church, but my mom and I never set foot in the Lutheran church together, and that's who I lived with growing up. So in some ways, No? Okay. Yeah? What do you think?
We'll give it to him. We'll give it to him. Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, and so now what we want to do with us playing that game with you all, we want you all to do that with each other. And so we want you to have a conversation partner, two or three, and we want you to ask, what are three things that people wouldn't know just by looking at you? Right, we want to give you an opportunity to kind of go beneath the surface of what the stories that we make up just by looking at people and go delve a little bit deeper. And so turn to your neighbor or get in groups of, or maybe three if you need to, but find someone. Ask them, what are three things you wouldn't know just by looking at you?
Seconds. A really unlikely thing, like something that's just people would not suspect this about you if they saw you. Anybody have just a crazy one that bucks a stereotype? Yeah. Okay, let's listen. Listen up.
Shh. Y'all wouldn't know that I cuss like a sailor all day.
Okay. All right. Cuss like a sailor. All right. Well, as Joe already mentioned, you know, as we look at these faces, sociologists have basically told us that we have this implicit bias. We have this story, this narrative that runs. So I could look at any one of these people, and if I'm not, you know, doing the metacognition, like what my man Glenn was talking about earlier, what can happen is that I literally can tell you what the faith is of this person. I can tell you what TV shows they like. I can tell you what their education level is. I can really go with a story. And so what Joe and I want you to do is, as you're looking around this room, guess what? You have a story about us, right? We already know that because you raised your hand about some of these things. So, and we have a story about all of you. And so what Joe and I want to encourage you to do this week is to use what we call compassionate curiosity and appreciative inquiry to be able to say, I'm having this story about this person. I wonder how much of that is accurate and how much of that is totally off. And did anybody get like 100% on those five? Exactly. There you go. So that should give us all a posture of humility in this work to be able to say, okay, I know that this is going to continue because God gave us this beautiful brain that can tell where there's danger. And you can see a tree and there's fruit from the tree and that's beautiful. And then this is a tiger and that's going to eat me and that's not good. And I can tell the difference. And thank you, God, for that because now I'm still alive because of that. However, that same ability to be able to put things in buckets is also what really fails us at times in this work. So before you just put things into the bucket, because your brain can't actually handle the ambiguity of not having the story resolved. So there's a stress hormone that's actually released in your brain when you don't know everything about somebody. However, this is the crossroads. This is that liminal space because when we're in that moment, what also can give us those good endorphins, you know, those good hormone release is wonder and awe and inquiry. That can also if we go there with it. So we encourage you to go to wonder rather than go to the stress of ambiguity. Can we do that? At least try to do it? Cool.
Ooh, cool, cool. Well, yeah, I'm glad you all are all vibing with that. And as we try to create this space of awe and wonder and compassionate curiosity and appreciative inquiry together, we want to name some of those things that help us make that container together. And so we want to kind of have some rules of engagement, some community guidelines that we're going to create together. We like to use the word brave space because some spaces aren't safe for anyone, right? And so how do we create a space where we can feel safe enough to delve into these conversations? And we can also practice courage together. And what does that look like for each of you? Because we each have different needs, different desires, and how to shape that space. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to write down some things that you all feel is really important to make that a space where we can have mutual vulnerability, we can practice being courageous together. But what does that look like to you all? I just want to write a few things down here on the board. If anyone has something, yes.
Speak for yourself.
Speak for yourself. Yeah, beautiful. Can you tell me more about what you mean when you say that?
Rather than to other people or other groups of people, just speak from your own experience.
Yeah, speak from your own experience. Yeah.
So can we repeat what everybody says since
yes,
we can't
yes.
pass
so,
on?
So speak for yourself. Rather than speaking on behalf of other people, speak from your own lived experience. Yeah. All right.
Confidentiality.
Yeah.
We call it the Vegas rule in there,
something. Yep, yep. Confidentiality. Yeah, anything else? You all can just say them out.
Non-judgmental.
Non-judgmental, yeah. And even if we do have some judgments, we can hold them lightly and have space between them.
Right? Curiosity.
Yeah.
Assume positive intent.
Yes. Assume positive intent.
Honesty.
Honest. Yeah. These are great. These are good.
Anthropologist versus missionary or teacher or judge or any other or salesperson to be approaching a person as if they represent another world, and I get curious about who they are in that world. So for me, being an anthropologist is kind of code for all of that.
Anthropologist, okay. Yeah, what's I'm trying to think of a way.
Discovery about
discovery. That. I like yeah, discovery. Okay, yeah. I'm trying to think of some succinct ways to
teamwork and mutual support.
Great.
Teamwork and mutual support.
Thank you.
For those listening at home.
Right on, right on. I think this is great, and I also want to say I don't think this will be a definitive or comprehensive community agreement, but I want us to visibly see what we want the space to look like and what we want to hold together going forward. So I'm going to leave this up here, and if we want to add something later on, we can add something. But we also have some other things that we listed. Even if you look in your folders, I think we have the respectful dialogue in there as well. But these are some things to keep in mind as we go forward together. You named a lot of these already. We want to be intentional about looking these things up. So possible things to keep in mind are similar to speaking from your own experience, but using I statements. Your personal experience is not necessarily shared by everyone. Even if it is someone who has had similar experiences as you, they still may not feel or think the same way that you do. And then assume best intentions, right? We have that as well. And give the most respectful interpretation you can for your neighbor's actions. What is it that you call it, Dave?
I stole that from my dad. It's MRI, most respectful interpretation.
Yeah, give people an MRI,
yeah.
Respectful interpretation. Yep. Yeah. And then be aware of power dynamics and how much space you take up. So there may be some instances in which we're taking up too much space and you want to step back a little bit, maybe not talk so much and give space to other people. And there may also be some instances in which you do need to take up more space, where your voice needs to be heard and you can claim your power and step into that space more. But we got to be aware of those power dynamics. We're definitely going to unpack that more about what those power dynamics are, but I think we're aware of that already. And with those areas that we are aware of, we want to move accordingly. So, and embrace ambiguity, kind of have some of that as well, and that discovery, not always needing to be right or wrong or to have something resolved, but being open to the questions and the awe and wonder. Resist the urge to posture yourself as an expert. We are all learners in this work, and it's okay to not know everything. I like to say we're all experts of our own experience, but we all have something to give and something to share, but there's lots of we still have to learn as well, so let's keep that posture of humility. And please do not share things that are shared in this group without permission from the group. So again, that confidentiality, that Vegas rule, and then if you tend to check out of difficult conversations, lean in. If you are always the one shouldering the burdens of these difficult conversations, we give you permission to opt out when you need to. So I like to call it holy discomfort, right? I think the holy discomfort is this discomfort that we need to grow because there's no growth outside of that comfort zone. But then there's some spaces where you've already been uncomfortable for so long. This is maybe a space of like discrimination or oppression, and like you just have to take care of yourself. There has to be self-care around that particular subject, and so we give you permission to opt out of that as well. So yeah, do you think we can all agree to this, carrying forward this type of space? Yeah, I see thumbs up. Can we get thumbs up? Right on. Cool.
So let's just get a little sound wave here. I say the word culture, and there's, I don't know how many people in here, but there's probably more definitions than people of culture in this room. So if you think about, I say the word culture, what does that mean to you all? Culture means
it's like a
what?
Word or something. We're just going to do a quick sound wave.
It's like system of customs and beliefs held by a group of people.
Oh, God.
Booyah. Okay. Oh, there we go. Okay.
You said anthropologist. You didn't know we had one in the room.
Who, did somebody else have something?
So how we do things around here.
How we do things around here. That's great. That's a good one.
It's always been done this way.
It's always been done this way.
Shared values.
Shared values.
Shared means of expression.
Shared means of expression.
It's sort of like what personality is for people.
Hmm. It's sort of like what personality is for people.
Oh, that's good.
Wow.
Okay. Social rules.
Social rules. Good. Good. Well, you all defined it probably better than what we have here. We have a couple of quick definitions. One is this. It says, a social system of meaning and custom that is developed by a group of people to assure its adaptation and survival. These groups are distinguished by a set of unspoken rules that shape values, beliefs, habits, patterns of thinking, behaviors, and styles of communication. So it's learned, and it's usually unspoken, and it's an adaptation for survival. Those are three really important components to it. So the very academic definition that I like to give is people who have figured out how to do life together. So kind of like what you said already. So So if you think about, you know, all the different groups that you belong to, and how, you know, you never learned, you didn't show up to your, you know, maybe your community of faith that you attend, and they didn't sit you down and go, okay, here's what you need to know. Okay, the Thomas family, don't ever talk about them, because they're elephant in the room, you know. By the way, this is how we're going to do worship. We're going to, you know, that's not what happened. That was all negotiated, and it was all unspoken. But you learned it quickly because you talked about the Thomas family, and they said, nope, we don't do that.
They're like, ooh, they just gave you the look. They didn't even say it. Like, ooh, right. Okay, I'm not going to do that again. And that's how we learned, right?
And you stepped in it, right?
Yep,
so,
yep.
So, and the funny thing is that most of what we talk about with culture, when we're trying to engage with others, most of the time we're looking at objective culture, which is above the iceberg. So talk about art, dress, drama, music, food, celebrations, crafts, dance, literature, language. Those are things that you can see, and those are things that are maybe a little easier to engage with, right? So, hey, we're going to have, we have this, you know, Latinx congregation that is renting out our space, and we're a traditionally Norwegian Lutheran congregation, and we're going to have them be with us, and we're going to get together once a year for a meal. You know, we're going to share food together. Okay, but now we decided to go a little deeper together, and we're going to actually share ministry. And now we got all this here. It was great when we were just eating food together. But now, look at all this. We got different assumptions about all kinds of stuff, about concepts of time, concepts of how we do conflict, how we do, I mean, any number of these things, right? Concepts of how do we raise our kids? Joe and I do some consulting work, and we work with some of these congregations where there's very different ideas, two different ethnic communities that have very different ideas about how you raise your kids. And so, you know, maybe the children have been kind of messing up the sanctuary, and this host congregation, because it is kind of this paternalistic relationship, which that's a whole nother thing, is now angry at these kids. You messed up our sanctuary, and you know, you let your kids do that, and now we're in conflict, right? So this is really, really messy. It's very messy. So how do we get better at this? Well, that's what we're here for, is to try to learn how to do that.
Yes, any practice.
Any thoughts about this? Any comments about this? Has anybody experienced the joys and the challenges of this?
Yeah, see him back here? Yeah.
Put flesh on the bones, yes.
Yeah.
We have a Hispanic congregation.
So I'm from Birmingham, Alabama, who grew up in white Iowa with no diversity. Diversity was considered Lutherans versus Catholics or German versus Irish. Although it wasn't as bad as being Norwegian versus Swedish. Yeah. I married into that. But in our church, we have a large Hispanic congregation that is, again, that paternalistic. It's a white congregation with, you know, 3-4 masses and then one ginormous Hispanic congregation. And when we try and do our liturgies around Easter, especially, you know, Ash Wednesday, and try and do both English and Spanish, and it's, you know, it's challenging. And then Alabama, as you may know, had the very harsh immigration laws where they tried to make people basically self-deport. So they used to have a really beautiful music ministry, and then all of a sudden it disappeared. You know, they lost 20% of their 1,000 people that attend that mass at 1 o'clock. I'm Catholic. And 20% disappeared.
So we probably all carry around stories of pain about this. And so the stakes are high for this work that we do. One of the things that about we are storied beings, right? We already talked about this. We're always trying to make meaning, and we're telling stories, and it actually affects our brain. The cultural stories that we inherited start to affect what we see and what we don't see. So, for example, on this picture on the left, it's kind of small, but if you look at this picture, depending on if you come from a more collectivist culture versus an individualistic culture, you will know that your eye will go to different parts of the picture. So if you come from a more of an individualistic culture, you may focus on you may focus on one individual in the foreground. If you come from a collectivist culture, you would notice more of the community. You'd notice the larger, other folks in the picture.
And also, I want to add too, it's not necessarily like there's a right or a wrong either. It's just the way we're raised, just the behavior patterns, the way we're acculturated. So seeing that one person doesn't mean you're a bad person, or seeing that collective doesn't mean you're a good or bad person either. It's just the way, you know, we think as far as cultures go.
Yeah, so I was in a class in seminary, and we were learning about the prodigal son. And, you know, I'm talking to my classmate, and I'm like, this is such a great story of, you know, this individual who, you know, left and then came back and received grace and forgiveness from this one individual. And there was a classmate of mine from Kenya, and he was like, that's not how we see that. That's not how we see it at all. He said, we understand it as the community failed this child, and the community is restoring, you know, this. And I was like, whoa, mind blown. I never thought of the prodigal son that way. So it affects the way we see our world, and we have to just be more and more aware of the fact that we have these stories that we walk around with.
Yeah,
Speaking of, so
the way we break down culture is into these diversity dimensions. And so we have all of these diversity dimensions, and these are how we see the world, where we see the world from, and they really shape all of our experiences. We always, at all times, are carrying these, but we may not be aware of all of them. And so we want to give ourselves the opportunity to increase our self-awareness of these diversity dimensions that we carry with us and how they impact ourselves and others. And so we want to do this. You want to do the exercise now?
Should
we
just do it?
Yeah, let's just dive right in. So we have an embodied exercise. As I said, this isn't just us talking. We're going to get in our bodies and move around and actually feel this thing. And so if you've noticed around the wall here, we actually have some of these diversity dimensions on there. And if you look inside your folders, you have red circle stickers. And so what we want you to do is to, we'll give you a few minutes just to think about this and look at these diversity dimensions that are actually going to be on the wall here. Does everyone have stickers? And I know some of you didn't get folders either, so we have extra stickers.
I did, yeah.
That's really
good. Well, yeah, we have a whole lot of them. So each person's going to get, is it four?
Only three.
Yep. So you only get three votes only, and what we want you to do is to put a sticker on the diversity dimension that shapes your experiences the most. What are the three?
I'm gonna go through them, and some of you are asking, why do you put them so low? I can tell you, this is actually a cultural moment, right?
Why they're so low as well.
So I'm 6'1", and you know, I used to put them up like way up high. You know, oh, everybody can see them. Well, we had somebody in a wheelchair just a few sessions ago in Houston. That was like maybe last year, and they're like, I cannot reach these at all. And so I was like, okay, boom, check that. Yeah, I stepped in it again, like what we were talking about. So. Yeah. Now I keep them nice and low. Unfortunately, maybe some of you can't see them. So we'll just read them so you know.
We want to invite you all to come down to participate as well. So, yeah.
So over here we have gender, age, or we might say gender identity, age, race, abilities, disabilities, socioeconomic status, education, sexual orientation, religion, hometown roots, family background, language, nationality, other.
If there's one that we didn't put up there that you think is real. But again, I really want you to take the time to reflect on this and think which of these impacts your experiences the most. It may not even be one that you're always aware of. It might just be one that you're so immersed in, such a part of your culture, such a part of your way of being and thinking that you don't even have to think about it because it's just a part of who you are. But put three stickers on the ones that you feel impact you the most. If you need some stickers, let us know. We have plenty down here.
Three.
To your seat, we'll have some time to dialogue around this. I already hear some good stuff out there from even those people who are walking past. I heard some really great observations. Yeah. Alright, friends. So we want to break this down a little bit more. And I'm curious to learn, what was it that surprised you about this? Was there something that you didn't expect after going through this exercise? Was like, wow, I didn't know that was going to happen that way. What did you choose and why? What was something that's like striking you as different? Anyone?
I think my first stop was like instantly I knew which one it would be. Mm-hmm. And then the next couple were so obvious to me.
What was your first
instantly
one?
She knew what it was
first one
and then the rest weren't as obvious to her, obvious. She said.
Yeah, yeah. And how did you settle on those, the other ones that you finally did?
I don't know, I just felt they just fell in the right place. You know, it's like, okay, yes, I can, this one makes sense now that I'm pausing and thinking about it.
Yeah, have you had the opportunity to really think about it before, though? Sometimes we're just so immersed in it, we don't even give the space and time to reflect on it. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I think for me, the only obvious one, the first one for me, was race. But after that, there were balances, like you could think socioeconomic status, but then education. I got my job because I got this degree in education. But you hear of people who are low socioeconomic status who can still get scholarships and do well and get an education, you know. So you're trying to balance all the things that are kind of random and might, you know, might still allow you to do well in other situations for the other two.
Another just intercultural competence moment is passing the microphone, because we know that there's different levels of ability to hear in the room as well. So we'll try to honor that as best we can. I'll try to do my Oprah Phil Donahue thing for the elderly that remember that.
Excuse me?
What?
Careful.
You gotta say generationally gifted.
Generationally gifted.
Yeah. Any other epiphanies? Yeah.
I think that a lot of these, where even though we've realized now that
even though we're white, race has an effect on us. A lot of these are invisible to us, like ability, my ability. I'm able to do anything, really. And so that I'm blind to the fact that I'm so affected by my ability to do things. And gender was one that I put down because that affects everything that I do. But maybe if you're male, you don't even notice it. It doesn't even register. And I think there's a lot of things that kind of fall into that.
Yeah. What you're hitting on is something we sometimes talk about as right-handedness. Like, how many folks in here are left-handed? Who's left-handed? How often are you reminded that you're left-handed?
All the time.
How often do we right-handed folks think about being right-handed?
Never.
We never really have to think about it, but the left-handed folks all the time, right? And that's some interesting dynamics there. You talk about like dominant culture and minoritized culture. Yeah, non-dominant culture.
I've been living in Eastern Europe for the last 10 years. So these first three, nationality, language, and my family of origin from Virginia, jumped out right away. And then I wished I'd had a fourth vote, because the one it's still invisible to me is my maleness. It's my gender. I'm totally stepping in it all the time, as you say, David, and not even realizing it.
Yeah, I would join you on the ability, disability one. This time, I think it was the first time, I've done this exercise once before, and this was the first time that actually came up, because I'm recovering from a very bad sprain, and I'm currently relearning how to walk normally, but I was in a boot for about a month and on crutches. And I live in Paris, France, and I can tell you that they did not develop their public transportation system for people with disabilities. And I think it was the first time that that was really striking to me, having to navigate that. And yeah, it's sometimes, I think, slightly embarrassing when we're face-to-face with that all of a sudden, because I was put in that situation of having a disability, and that's when our eyes are opened, you know?
Yeah, and our awareness of the things change depending on which context we're in, right? I heard someone say that as they were walking past, like, sometimes this is different depending on if I'm at work or I'm at church or I'm at school or I'm at home. My awareness is different depending on who I'm with and in that space and how I'm moving in that space. So, yeah, that's a great point.
Not to be too politically correct, but I think us talking about disability versus ability is also like the majority of... We assume that everybody can use both eyes, both feet, both hands, both, you know, and that we think in a certain way. I would like the term differently abled, you know, because I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of silent difference in abilities. And I think of, you know, there's probably a number of us in this room who have a child or someone with, for example, autism. Or, I mean, you could go on and name any number. And is it a disability? It can be differently abled.
Yeah, thank you for that. No, I appreciate that. That is language we use sometimes. We should have put that on there. But yeah, that's beautiful. We want to be aware of that as well. The language that we use is really important. So, yeah.
Did we just step in it again?
I think we did. Boom, right there.
Thank you.
That's key. That's key in this work, is like we've messed up already, and we're going to continue to mess up. But how do we learn to fail forward and to create the space? We have learning opportunities, and we can, you know, in community, do better. So
the one thing I just want to say about that is that, you know, if we understand racism or ableism or any of these as systems in which we unwittingly participate, then we're much more receptive to people calling us out, right? Like, I'm so grateful that you mentioned that, and I don't feel like, oh, she's coming at me. I got to defend myself and show her how to do my performative wokeness, man. Let me show you. Like, the pressure is totally off to have to do that and just to do better. And, like, I want to know. So thank you very much for sharing that. And I think if we could reframe that conversation, it not like, you're this horrible person with nefarious intentions, but, hey, you're probably a good person. I just want to let you know that you kind of stepped in it there. That was racist, what you just said. And like... You know, what would it look like if we would hear that from somebody and be like, oh, thank you so much. Like, how many people of color have ever called somebody out and had somebody be like, wow, thank you so much? Usually that's not the... No, but I got a black nephew, man. What are you talking about, man?
Like, yeah, going to the fragility and the guilt.
Yeah.
Like, the way I like to phrase it is we're calling people in. We want to call each other in instead of calling them out. Calling them into their best selves, right? And that's the beauty of community, is when we're in relationship with each other, then we can do that.
And that's what we're hoping to create the space for.
So you just called us in. So thank you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate that. Yeah, we can give some love to that. Yeah, for sure.
Anything else you want to say about this?
Nah, this is something we can continue to carry forward as we do some other exercises. But be increasingly aware of how you're carrying forward those diversity dimensions. Yeah.
Cool. So the way that we define intercultural competence is this capability to shift cultural perspective and adapt or bridge behavior to cultural commonality and difference. And so, you know, one of the ways that we were, both Joe and I were trained with this guy, Dr. Mitchell Hammer, and he created this intercultural development continuum, and we'll get to it in a second. But one of the things that he talks about is this ability to behave appropriately and authentically between two cultures. That's what we're going for. Now, those are in dynamic tension with each other, because what might be appropriate in one moment may not be authentic for me, and so how we negotiate that is a whole nother conversation, but that's what we're going for. And it's this ability to be able to pay attention to similarity and difference. So if we overemphasize similarity, we end up in conformity, and we don't want that. And if we overemphasize difference, we end up in fragmentation, and we don't want that. So it's, how do we place a proper emphasis on both? And that's where the generative goods come from. That's what we want. That's the good stuff. So I'll get to it. We'll go back to that video. There were teams that were studied. And there were three types of teams. The first type of teams were these multicultural teams where the leaders were not able to glean the gifts of the diversity in the room. Has anybody ever seen a team like that, or maybe even been on a team like that? Man, we already tried that diversity stuff. That doesn't work, man. We failed as a team. Well, chances are it's this first group. It's because the leader wasn't able to actually create enough safety and inclusion for people to actually offer their gifts. The second team was the monocultural teams, and they did pretty well. They were kind of middle of the pack. The team that outperformed the other two teams were the multicultural teams, where the leaders were actually able to acknowledge and support cultural differences. So if you think about, I live by 3M, sort of. It's in my same area. 3M, they invent a bunch of cool things, scotch tape, all that kind of stuff. And so what will happen is, you got these four scientists and they're all in a room and they're all, at least traditionally, they're all these like white middle-aged dudes that, are kind of all thinking about this problem. And then there's like this woman of color in the back who's pretty much being ignored because these dudes are like kind of taking over things. And she's like, did you ever think about this way of looking at it? And like a lot of times that's where the breakthrough comes from.
I think they made a movie about that called Hidden Figures.
Exactly. And I think theologically too, right? We sit around with people, oh, I see God this way. Oh, I do too. Yeah, let's hang out together. And somebody else is like, but wait, I see God this way. And all of a sudden, boom, God gets so much bigger for us. So this is just
that's
best.
That's what Jesus did.
Amen.
And we, a lot of times we say, like, I don't think that my image of God is even complete without hearing your image of God, how you experience the spirit and the divine. I have as you said, it gets bigger, but it's not even full without you being in the picture. Like, we all need to create that image together. So
say that.
Yeah. That'll preach.
So I was going to mention this. This is kind of the businessy reason. People have identified that this is one of the top 10 skills, work skills needed for the future. So this is like when you're meeting, hey, do you want to get a great job and get ahead in life? You should have cross-cultural competence. But we hopefully named other important reasons why that's good. So we're going to show you another commercial that kind of touches on this.
I think I got to pull it up on here.
And because I'm involved, it's probably not going to work. I am a curse.
Yeah, I did that. Okay, that's my
It's a really cool video.
With the mouse, though, it's like I'm clicking and it's not even doing anything.
I tried.
Where's our technology friends?
Yeah.
Not me.
It's good. It's not like super essential. We can, I mean, it's cool, but there's other ways to teach it.
Did you download it, Joe?
Do a right click, maybe. Yeah, do a right click.
Yeah.
Did you try that? Like a, that's the wrong one. But, hey, there we go. There we go. Hey, no. It's only right. Yeah, it's doing the wrong. Hey. How'd you? What's that? Who knows how to get it to?
Down there, down the bottom.
Space bar?
There.
Hit escape right now.
To the left, the arrow.
It's like the golden shop.
Oh, I'm not trying to play this one.
We're not trying to play that one.
It's a different one.
We're trying to get to that tab right there and like get it to show us that tab.
Let's try it.
Right.
Oh, you don't have USB on there? How did you get it to work just a second ago, the way you did it?
Press Control 1.
Control 1? We got a techno. We got anybody younger than 20 years old? Here we go. Control 1. Try Control 1, he says.
We got an engineer here. He's 21, Dave.
Okay? See?
She's 1 year old.
This is generational diversity right here. This is the power of this. This is what we're talking about, people.
Here comes an engineer, Dave. Joe.
Oh, you got... No? That's new tab. There we go. How'd you do that?
Yeah,
just
stay up there.
Yeah, just stay up here, seriously.
Let's make some noise for him. Ladies and gentlemen, oh, I should say folks, because I don't use gender language either.
Siblings.
Siblings, here we go.
It's a slur on your host's food if you don't clear your plate. Whereas the Chinese feel you will question their generosity if you do. Which is why we have local banks staffed by local people in the aid of the
So this is why it's so important. We want to save you from these moments. So there was a sociologist in the early 80s that was studying students and trying to see how they responded to cultural difference. And so Milton Bennett was looking at students that maybe they would, you know, return back from studying abroad, or maybe it was just, you know, students that were, hey, we're in the cafeteria, you're a Muslim student here, tell me about, you know, how you navigate that, how do you negotiate that. And so they began to do this research, and they, what Dr. Bennett came up with was, it's called the developmental model of intercultural sensitivity, and that was like the precursor to what we're about to show you, which is the intercultural development continuum. So Mitchell Hammer had worked with Dr. Bennett, and they eventually broke off, and then Dr. Hammer took this and riffed on it, and so that's what we're going to show you here, is this intercultural development continuum. So he discovered that students had one of kind of five responses to cultural difference, generally speaking. The first one was denial. So he found that some students, they call it benign neglect. Like, you know what? I'm not really interested. I'm not really super interested in cultural difference. It's not on my radar. I don't have anything against anybody from a different culture. It's just not my thing. So that was kind of the first orientation that people had. And Joe will tell you about the second. Oh, the graph I have here is, it's kind of that, usually it connotes some privilege. I was thinking about Moana, of like being on an island, and like, I know there is, what's the song?
Somebody's got another
Somebody sing song. Sing it for me. There's beyond the shore, there's something else out there, but.
Right, but there were some of the folks were denying the difference.
Yeah, exactly.
Right on. And so the second one here we have is polarization. And so polarization is when you de-emphasize the differences and you
so you judge differences.
I was reading it, but I know this. So it's when you judge the differences, but there's two different types of polarization. And so you can either overemphasize the importance of or the value of your own culture and de-emphasize the value of another's culture. Or there's also what's called reversal, which is where you overemphasize the value of another's culture and de-emphasize your culture. And so the way this sometimes has happened, like if folks are to like travel to another country and they see for the first time how things are done, and they like fall in love with the way this culture does things, like everything they do here is perfect. Everything they do back home sucks. And so that's polarizing, right? It's polarizing the two differences of culture instead of holding them together. And then another way it can happen is if you're focusing or more emphasis on your own personal culture, the way you think and experience things, and de-emphasizing another's. So there's two different sides of polarization. And then we have
And just one thing I want to say about this. So this is both of these first two that we talked about are the monocultural mindset. And one of the things about the monocultural mindset is that it fails to usually see, it's usually a caricature of another culture. So whether you're over-romanticizing another culture or demonizing another culture, it still is, can potentially be dehumanizing to that culture. Can I get an amen? Okay.
But also, one of the things that we emphasize overall with these different orientations is that it's not meant to put guilt, blame, or shame on any of these orientations, because you only know what you know. You don't know what you don't know. So these are based on your lived experiences. So wherever folks are on these orientations across this continuum, it's not meant to say, like, this is a good thing or a bad thing. This is just how we've understood, how we've come to behave, to interact with those cultures. But it's developmental, so we can continue to have learning opportunities to continue on.
Does anybody have a hobby that they enjoy? Okay, what are you into?
Dungeons and Dragons.
Dungeons and Dragons. And the first time you touched the Dungeons and Dragons board, were you killing it or were you not killing it? Or were you just a natural?
That's a complicated question.
Okay.
But I was, struggled.
And you've gotten better since?
I think so.
And what was helpful for you? How did you
Doing
get better?
A lot.
Doing it a lot.
A lot of practice, yeah. I would say you do best what you do most. So the more we're able to step outside our comfort zones and engage in cultural difference, in different capacities, we build our capacity. We get better at it. Practice. I don't say practice doesn't make perfect, but practice makes progress, right? And so the more we can do this, the better we'll get at it. So.
And if you think about, like me, I'm, like, let's say music, if we have any musicians, when you first, people who have not really spent a whole lot of time around a piano, you sit down at a piano, would you ever feel guilt, like, and shame that you weren't, like, nailing the piano, right? You probably wouldn't, right? You say, well, maybe I need to just get around a piano more, and I need to actually find some teachers that can help me. So part of this methodology is we don't hold people responsible for thoughts and experiences that they haven't had yet. And because that's what moves the needle. It doesn't move the needle to when we guilt, blame, and shame people. It often does the opposite. And a lot of trainings that maybe some of you have been to are taught from polarization. And I just want to say this because I think it's important. It's developmental, and we understand. Oh, I could use a laser, but
I was so excited. I never had one of these.
But so you can only see one orientation ahead of you. You can see all the ones behind you, and so when we talk about the value of each orientation, one of the values of each orientation is if you're in polarization, you are a gift to somebody in denial. Because somebody in denial, the only thing that's going to move them forward is for you to be like, there's differences and they're challenging. You need to wake up. Come on. Like, that is actually helpful.
Say it more lovingly. Well, I mean, sometimes you got to be assertive.
Exactly. But that's really important for somebody in denial. Whereas, you know, for somebody who's like
focused. We haven't got here yet.
Yeah, we'll get there. Okay, sorry. Yeah. I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah. So, yeah, let's actually go forward into the other orientations here. So we already talked about denial and polarization. As we said, polarization has those two subcategories, right?
But I want to watch polarization.
Oh, yeah, let's watch it. All right. Yeah, for sure.
Just a couple more things here, though.
Yeah.
You won't read them all, but just take a look at it. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, anyone? One of the fun parts of this is you get to try to guess which orientation do I have?
In the assessment, when folks actually take the assessment, it's all self-guided. And so we don't tell people where they are. They are able to tell on themselves by taking the assessment. The assessment, the tool actually places you at an orientation. So, yeah. You remember that? There's only two things I hate in this world: people who are intolerant of other people's cultures, and the Dutch. And that's an example of polarization of defense. Yeah.
Here's
another great example here.
This is defense, and then we'll show you reversal.
Yep. So I have it down here. Now that I know how to use this mouse, I think what happened, just to defend myself, is that the setting of my mouse got changed somehow. Maybe after we plugged this in. But so we don't even need this anymore. Did that happen?
Right next to the left of that.
Nope.
Right.
Okay.
One more.
Pra,
P-R-O.
Oh, that was it. I was like, it's... Cool.
I don't know if you remember this, but hopefully you guys are good. Let me tell you a little story. So when I would leave for tour, my wife and my daughter, well, this is before my baby daughter was born, they would bond by going to these animal shelters, right, and playing with the cats. But here's the thing. I hate cats. Well, hate is a strong word. It's just that I'm more of a dog person, but these cats, demon spawns, I don't trust them. They always look like they planned a murder, right? Like cats be put in work. You ever seen a movie? What does the weird old lady have? What about the village pets? They evil. You know, ancient Egyptians did that, and they built the pyramids. So they were all to something, right? But I would receive these terrifying images in my text of my daughter smiling in the throes of full bliss, holding what has to be the biggest letdown of a cousin. You know, cats are related to lions. You share taxonomy with tigers. Tigers! Why are you so cupcake? Why does my daughter have to have one of all things? Cat. Hate cats. Well, hate's a strong word. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's not like... I'm not like a bigot or nothing. Like, I mean, I don't see species. You know, my babysitter, when I was a kid, she had a cat. And I'm sure among you are nice, God-fearing people who have cats in their home. Just not in my home. They stink. They be rubbing their terrible pheromones all over my furniture. But alas, can't even scream it. I force a smile on my face as she brings this thing home. To be honest, I thought I raised her better than that. See, we are a dog family. We stick to our own kind. How come you couldn't love a dog? This is just the words of a concerned father. People may think a certain way about her when she walks down the street. And why you walking a cat anyway? People don't think I ain't raised my child well. And it's not like this cat did anything to me personally. I just know they kind. See, I be seeing them on the news. They be tearing up the homes that they owners provide for you. Why would you tear up your own home? Why are cats not grateful? Why are they all lazy? They be complaining about their oppression. You can see it in their eyes. Don't the owners that take care of you take care of you well? Haven't we had cats in the White House? Ain't that enough? But this cat got in my home, and it was a little different. Actually, I enjoyed my time with her, but that's not the point. The point is, I've already made my decision. It's my heritage. It's not hate. I come from a dog family. It's my heritage. Not hate. Hate's a strong word. We're still talking about cats, right?
So that's an example of polarization right there.
Can anybody think of another example of polarization defense? I don't know, anybody watch the news or?
So that's one of the subcategories of polarization as defense. And here is an example of polarization reversal.
This environment reminds me of the ghetto. This environment reminds me of the hood. So as you can see, her hair literally looks like it's a sponge. If you put your hands in her hair, you probably lose a finger. The smell is just like so overwhelming, like I just want to die. And it's way too many African Americans. That's probably some of the reasons why it smells. There's dog right there. Like there's actual dog right there. Like someone really needs to clean up. All these people look like pickpocketers, like they all just look like they're gonna steal from you. African Americans are more known to actually commit crimes than Caucasian people, so I mean, you never know with them. They have giant lips, their noses are really, really big, and they're just like really ghetto. It's like completely disgusting how ghetto they are, like honestly. Like, where did they come from? This is why they're called monkeys in the first place, because they don't know how to act. I could never live in this filth and among all of these African-Americans and among all of these people who clearly have absolutely no class. African-Americans just, they ruin everything good.
Does it occur to you that you might be hurting people's feelings? You might be causing someone pain with the things that you say?
Well, I believe African Americans don't really have feelings and don't care.
Do you just have a list of things that you say to be outrageous?
Oh, no. I feel like, honestly, everything I say is the truth. I mean, stereotypes are stereotypes for a reason. Someone had to make them up, you know? Someone actually had to look at a black person and say, wow, you're really fat. It's a black stereotype. Almost all black people have diabetes. All of them are fat.
Right? I have diabetes.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I feel so bad for you. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm doing all right.
We're worried about you, sweetheart.
I think the only reason why people are like laughing is because you guys act like you've never heard people say this before. It's just because I'm going to step. I'm actually going to say what everyone else is thinking because it's the truth. But I'll say it.
If you disagree with what she's saying, stand up.
All of them are liars. All of them are liars. And behind closed doors, they type the same thing as me. They're just quiet about it. That's it. And you can hear by the reaction in the crowd, some of them are African Americans, because I can hear the fact that it's getting real loud in here.
You need some help big time.
That's a little bit extreme. That's not, but...
I mean, that is an example of polarization, but that's an extreme example. Like, we're laughing and cringing, but...
Yeah. Should we go ahead and go to the next one?
Yeah, let's go to minimization. All
right, let's see which one is.
Well, I was saying let's show them on the go to the slide first.
Okay. Here we go.
So one of the things that also happens with reversal, as you saw, was internalized oppression. So, you know, whether it be, I don't know, maybe some of you have like seen women who might say, like, man, I don't know what's up with this, like, Me Too movement, and why are women so uptight about this? Or, you know, any of those things where we've internalized messages from society and we begin to exhibit those behaviors. So that's another place where this can happen. Then minimization is the next one. So take a look at minimization. There's two forms of minimization, just like there's two forms of polarization. So the first one for minimization is dominant cultural minimization. So dominant cultural minimization is the right-handedness that Joe was talking about earlier. So if you think about these identities that you have, and we already talked about not being aware of these, right? Who had mentioned that? They said, my dominant cultural identities are the ones that are really hard to see, right? So one of the things is just that lack of awareness of one's own cultural pattern. So if you're, for example, the example I like to give is at Luther Seminary where I work. If you're a Lutheran at Luther, you're not really interrogating the Lutheranness of Luther. You're just like, yeah, this is the way everybody worships. And this, if you're a Baptist or a Catholic or a Pentecostal and you come to Luther, you're like, whoa, this place is Lutheran, you know? So similarly, that's the dominant cultural expression of minimization. However, there's the non-dominant cultural expression, which is go along to get along, right? And that's that. That's a strategy for survival, to say, you know what, I don't know if this is safe space for me, so I'm going to check parts of me at the door before I walk into this place, because I don't know if I can be queer in this institution. I don't know if I can be Buddhist in this church or whatever it might be. So we minimize parts of our identity in order to survive sometimes, literally, whether it be emotionally or physically. So this is minimization, and I guess this would be considered probably dominant cultural minimization.
Don't we incredible super diverse identities last year?
Diversity, yes.
Yeah, like Moonlight or Lion, Hidden Figures, influences. Maybe you said it didn't like just feature white people.
So interesting. I never really thought about that.
Really? Even after the whole Oscars So White thing and all the articles written about it?
Call me crazy, but I just race.
There's a little language in this.
Racist person
here.
Okay. Race is like often like
yeah,
pretty obvious thing to observe. It's not like racist to notice.
I had to laugh. Zach, oh my goodness, I only see one race. The human race.
Such bullshit. You're only telling yourself that so you don't have to think about racism or confront your own prejudices.
No, I'm not prejudiced, okay? I don't even judge Scott for being a woman.
I'm a man, Katie, you know that.
No, honestly, I just guessed. This is gonna sound nuts, but I don't see gender and I don't see sex. I just see people.
You don't see how men and women look different?
No, I just see, like, shapeless blobs.
If one of those shapeless blobs were pregnant, you would then know that it was a woman.
To me, it could just be, like, a heavy-set man who has, like, a big watermelon stomach. Mm. Okay? I just am so committed to equality. I'm just a good person.
Unless you're blind, you can tell that people have inherent differences.
Oh, I wouldn't know if I was blind or not because I don't see disability. I'm a monster.
So, if someone were in a wheelchair, you wouldn't be able to see a wheelchair.
I have never seen a wheelchair.
You've never seen a wheelchair.
I don't know what a wheelchair looks like.
If someone were in a wheelchair, you would not install a ramp in your building.
I would refuse.
But what if someone was missing a limb?
It's perhaps tucked under their little butt.
If someone were deaf.
Talk to them as if they could hear.
Why are you so proud of yourself?
Okay, well, here's a thought. Maybe you don't get it because you have less experience on Earth than I do.
Experience? We're all older than you.
I'm sorry, but I don't see age.
Oh, come on. You're telling me if there was an old woman and a baby, you wouldn't be able to tell which one's older? One of them's called an old woman. It's in the name, Katie.
Because I believe in equality. everyone is the same age.
That's not what equality means.
You have two older brothers. Can you at least acknowledge that?
Yes, and I believe both women are my same age.
Okay. What about your parents? How old were they when they had you?
I think they are both ageless and every age at the same time.
Jesus Christ, Katie. What else, Katie?
Pretty much everything. Baldness, for example.
So Bruce Willis.
Is he bald?
He's famously bald.
I have no idea.
Katie, why are you doing this? Sounds pretty good. I mean, I guess I can understand that.
She admits it.
Hi, it's Katie Mirovich from
So that's an example of, an extreme example again, of what minimization looks like. So, yeah.
So we talked about there's a blessing and a blind spot in each of these. This beautiful, you know, ability to see the commonality in every person. That's a wonderful thing, right? That ability to for me to look out here and see, I see beloved children of God, I see human beings, I see, you know, and I'm noticing similarities. And so that's a wonderful part of minimization.
Oftentimes call it the bridge building orientation. It's like usually the largest one, and it's seeking to find that unity and that togetherness. So that's one of the blessings of it, yeah, for sure.
And it works great, especially for dominant cultural folks, you know. It's a little harder for non-dominant cultural folks, like, you know, to be able to build a transportation system in Paris that works for the majority of the people is great, right? Good job on that. The problem is, it doesn't work for everybody. That's one of the challenges of minimization, so.
Yeah. So, would you get along? This is one of the ways we talked about that subcategory of the non-dominant culture, if you want to get along and go along, right? Watch the video there. So the next one on here would be acceptance. And so acceptance, cultural difference, acknowledged and respected. So there's no evaluative curiosity. So kind of what we talked about earlier, that compassionate curiosity, appreciative inquiry. Sometimes we call this like being a cultural detective. When you see the differences, you lean into the differences and try to like figure out, you know, what's going on there beneath the surface. And so more difference means more creative ideas, and it's celebrated. Recognized cultural patterns need to be understood from perspective of other cultures, and you begin to explore those differences on your own and see the behavioral relativism that's there. And so, yeah.
So one of the challenges of acceptance is that, you know, I see the difference, I understand that the difference is important.
Celebrate it even.
And celebrate it, but I have no idea what to do about it.
The like, behavioral part.
So I know that this is a Somali woman, and I'm greeting her, and I'm pretty sure I'm supposed to greet her differently, or potentially, because I found out that she's, you know, or I think she's probably Orthodox Muslim, and but I don't know what to do, so this is a true story. So I like lean in to hug her because that's what I thought we were doing in the room, and yeah, that didn't go so well. I don't hug any woman pretty much anymore, just for the record, but I ask a lot more permission now than I did. This was a few years ago.
Yeah, and so. this is again, I think that's a great example because this is going back to the developmental part of this model. And even as folks who are qualified administrators of this work, we're still always learning and growing as well, given our experiences that we have. So.
Yeah, so I knew I was supposed to do some. I just didn't have enough experience with Somali women to know what to do about the difference. So that's how we move from acceptance into adaptation, where we can actually, we have a skill set at that point. So here's acceptance. Anybody seen this before? Yeah.
It's easy to put people in boxes. There's us, and there's them. The high-earners, and those just getting by. Those we trust, and those we try to avoid. There's the new Danes, and those who've always been here. The people from the countryside, and those who've never seen a cow. The religious, and the self-confident. There are those we share something with, and those we don't share anything with.
Velkommen. Jeg kommer til at stille jer nogle spørgsmål i dag. Nogle af dem kan godt være lidt personlige, men jeg håber, I vil svare ærligt på dem. Hvem herinde i rummet var klassens...
Who in this room was a class clown? He asked them to walk over. Just in case you can't see the words. Our step-parents.
And then suddenly, there's us. We who believe in life after death. We who've seen UFOs. And all of us who love to dance. We who've been bullied. And we who've bullied others. And then there's us, the lucky ones who've had sex this past week. We who are broken-hearted. We who are madly in love. We who feel lonely. And we who acknowledge the courage of others. We who have found the meaning of life. And we who have saved lives. And then there's all of us who just love Denmark. So maybe there's more that brings us together than we think. TV2 Denmark. All that we share.
So you see this relationship between difference and similarity, and to really see the beauty of the difference, but then to also see the unity. A lot of times, Galatians 3, 26 through 28, when we talk about, when Paul is speaking about being one in Christ, you know, there's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for we're all one in Christ. He would say, see, we're all the same. We're one in Christ, we're not the same in Christ. And so that's really important distinction in that.
And then we have adaptation, and so we kind of talked about that already, just it's around that behavioral shift, being able to not only be aware of the differences and celebrate and affirm and honor those differences, but knowing how to act appropriately and authentically when engaging with those differences. So, oh wow, it's trying to play.
It's so easy to place people in boxes.
So one of the stories,
creating sides.
One of the stories I share with this is... One of the stories I share is growing up in a divorced family and going back and forth between my parents' house. And so I learned that when I was with my dad, they were vegetarian, right? So I learned how to eat in their house. When I would go to my mom's house, I could eat meat. my dad had a different curfew than my mom. And so I learned how to behave. I learned the rules of the road, and I knew how to just go back and forth and fluidly drop into both. And there's people that have grown up bicultural in this in a similar way. They know how to, I mean, Joe is like, if I can put you on blast for a minute, like he's high adaptation because, you know, growing up in Minot, North Dakota, going to Church of God in Christ, all black church, and then going back to...
All white school, you know, differences all over the place, and learning how to engage in those differences throughout my life. Also being a military brat and having family all over the country and traveling extensively. So I've always just learning. Those lived experiences, though, are what gave the space for me to have those learning opportunities. So,
and so Dr. Hammer believes that if you can learn how to do that between two cultures, it's like learning a language where then when you encounter a third culture, it becomes a little bit easier. So when you're anybody like first learn a culture and you're just like, okay, you know, you could dissect that moment of, okay, what did I do? Okay, I had a really close friend that I could ask dumb questions with. That's really an important component of this, right? I had guides on my journey. I did research. I learned about, you know, I read some books. I watched movies. So there's things you can do to develop these skills. These are hard skills and soft skills, both.
The journey never stops. Keeps going and going. So we already kind of talked about some of these things. We just wanted to glance at this here. But I think we should, like, about 5 minutes left. Less than 5 minutes.
But this is a good commercial here, Joe. We would be remiss if we didn't get a quick commercial in.
Yeah, please.
This IDI is a really awesome tool. Has anybody ever taken the Intercultural Development Inventory? A couple of you? Okay. So this is an assessment, whether you use me and Joe is... You don't have to use us, but there, it's a really great assessment. But you can. It's a great assessment that you can use as an organization or individual to assess your intercultural competence and kind of see where are we on this and locate yourself on this. And so, and then there's an intercultural development plan that you can have as well, which is a strategy to develop these skills. And we help you with that.
Hey, can I ask a question? Is it true that there's no way to move up that scale without stepping in it? So then what that tells me, I'm experiencing that now at this point in my life, is that a key capability is courage or grace or something to stop me from getting defensive or arguing or trying to minimize the truth of what's coming at me. Seems to me that's a core thing that's got to be starting way back on the scale going all the way through. Is that what's
cool. Cultural humility, I mean, the cultural humility is so important with this. And when I'm with somebody who says, you know, I'm really kind of a beginner in this, like a lot of times I'm like, okay, you might be an adaptation. Because we say that the work starts when you get an adaptation, basically. And so folks who have beginner's minds, they tend to usually do better on the assessment or have a higher score.
And it's also likely that there's going to be a gap. We call it the orientation gap. From where we perceive or we think we are to where the tool actually places us. So that's common. And so that just shows that we all have work to do. We all need to continue, you know, to give ourselves or allow ourselves to have those learning opportunities. And what's the number again? Is it 60? How many hours? Let's say at least.
Yeah.
For there to be a developmental growth.
Yeah, I mean, 40 to 60 hours.
40 to 60 hours. And
that's a big range.
Like recommended, but it's really like the more time you put in it, again, you practice, you do best what you do most. So the more practice you get, the more you're able to.
But it's not just the action. It's the action and the reflection.
Yep.
So you can be like, oh, I'm going to go to, you know, to North Minneapolis where there's a lot of black folks and I'm going to hang out in a coffee shop and that's going to automatically, you know, make me better at this. No, it's not, because if you're not interrogating your own thought patterns, you're just reinforcing the same ones. So if you're in minimization and you go to and you live in Japan for 10 years, you're like, oh, these people are really similar to me and they're similar to each other. And you're only noticing similarities because you're not interrogating that. So.
Right, so, but we all say action and reflection both together. When you're doing this, when you're doing the IDP, the Intercultural Development Plan, we always say you have to do both action and reflection. They go hand in hand together. That's the only way you can develop. So yeah, let's. I think we want to make sure you have enough time to get to Vespers, but we always have homework every day. So because you got to get this work. And so if you don't have a folder, let us know. But there is a sheet in your folder that will help you with this exercise. We call it S's and D's. And you should reflect on this in your time between tonight and when we meet again tomorrow. But go through it. And it actually kind of explains it on there, but I don't know if you wanted to break it down for them.
I think the biggest thing with S and D is just, like, what I love about this methodology is you can literally practice this right now. I can sit here, talk to my neighbors, and start to say, how am I similar? How am I different? What am I doing about the difference? Am I judging it? Am I minimizing it? Am I accepting it and adapting to it? So it's not like we're going to get in a spaceship and we're going to go, explore cultural diversity, like, you know, out there somewhere.
Right here, right
now. It's right here. And if you, just to... conclude here, look at this. Are you all noticing this?
There's
stickers on every single one here, as far as I can tell, which means that if we can't see the difference that's in this room, and if we can't adapt to it, accept it and adapt to it, like, what makes us think that a 96% white church of the ELCA that we belong to, that we're going to be able to do that work cross racially if we can't even do it if we can't even make a space that's more inclusive for, you know, Swedes and Norwegians to bring their full selves to the space. So
the work starts at home. So that's what it's all about right here, right now. That's where we begin. So we want to invite you all to do the S's and D's exercise. If you don't have a sheet, please let us know. We want to make sure you get one. And you can even just write it out, too. We can walk you through. You can write it on a blank sheet of paper. But yeah, so that's the homework. And the next time we meet, we'll have some dialogue around that. We'll go deeper into this work together. So, yeah.
And you get to define this. So if you, yeah, you know.
Self-guided.
Self-guided. Some of them you may not know, which is also revelatory. But pick the 10 people closest to you. That's a whole nother workshop that we could break down. Like, why did you pick those 10? Co-workers, you get to decide, but then you get to say, okay, what do I mean by religion? Do I know their religious identity? Do I not? What does that mean? So this is your chance to really hone in on it.
Joe, would you do your show up some night?
Yeah, I'm probably going to do that during our concert, which I guess I could, you know, a little promo right now, but yeah, we're going to do a concert on tomorrow evening, actually, after Vespers, so I'll probably share my poem entitled Show Up. And we're also going to be doing some stuff at Vespers as well tonight, so we should probably get over it.
Thank you for coming.